A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
What's going on, Rob?
We're at the Serpentine.
What?
I know, I'm really excited, and it's a beautiful summer's day.
Stunning day. We have just been in traffic in the heat, but it was a London taxi, so there was some air coming through.
And now we're surrounded by trees, and we're in our guest's office looking out onto Hyde Park.
But surrounded by books now in our guest's office.
Books everywhere. Which is interesting because our guest today has written a lot of great books over the years.
And I think these might all be his books that he's written. There's so many.
And I think also a lot of his early interest in art came through reading interviews of artists with critics and things. So we will discuss that as well.
Yes.
But we would like to welcome super curator Hans-Ulrich Obrist.
Hi, Hans.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to the Serpentine. It's great you're here. And we are in Kensington Gardens. And I was actually wondering the day today, because Ariel Obrist had this nice idea that he was always marked the moment, so he set the day. But I forgot, what's the day today? Do you
You've
remember?
You've got two phones in front of you, Hans.
Oh, it's two phones. Yeah, do you remember what's the day today? Is it the
17th?
Yeah, so we can do the Boiti thing. So it's the 17th day. It's the 7th month. It's the 19th year. It's the second decade. It's the first century. It's the third millennium. And we're in London.
So what does that mean?
It means we can celebrate this moment.
Oh, is it like a numerology thing you're giving us?
Love that. Yeah. We can add up all the numbers.
Why have you got two phones?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, one is my personal phone and the other one is the office phone. And then it's also just, I'm always worried if one wouldn't work, but then I would have no phone. So it's always good. And then, it's doubly.
Are you quite dependent on a phone then?
Always.
Is that just for like scheduling because you're such a busy man?
No, it's for lots of things. I mean, I use a lot of WhatsApp and messages, and then also Instagram.
Yes.
Because I started this movement of Instagram a couple of years ago to kind of protest against the disappearance of handwriting and doodling, because I was concerned that, I used to always write letters, receive letters, postcards, and then little by little this disappeared. And I started to realize also that people in general use handwriting less. And then Umberto Eco, the late Italian novelist and writer and semiologist, he once told me, you know, he really thinks that handwriting and calligraphy shouldn't disappear. We should come up with an idea to kind of bring it back. And then I was basically on a walk with the great artists Ite Latnan and Simon Fattal and Kouchang Ah, my partner, and we were basically in Brittany, in France, and it rains there a lot. So all of a sudden it started to rain and it would not stop, so we had to find shelter. We went to a coffee shop, and we had a long conversation, and the rain was persistent. And so after about 3 hours, we were still there waiting for the rain to stop. And, you know, after about 3 hours of conversation, Ku and Simone and I went on our phones, started to answer a few emails, whilst Etelle, the 93-year-old poet and artist, took out a notebook and started to write the poem. And I had not seen this in a long time, so it's very beautiful. I took a picture and posted it on Instagram. And that's what I've done ever since. You know, I have artists, poets, handwrite letters. And so that's why I need my phone a lot.
Did any of them ever say no? Has any of them ever said, no, I'm not going to write you something? Or has everyone been quiet?
Yeah, the only one who didn't want to do it was Rei Kawakubo.
Oh, really?
Because she says, that is your project, not mine. I don't understand it. So the only one.
She's the Comme des Garçons designer.
Exactly. Yeah. She's the only one who's ever turned it down. And then, you know, at a certain moment, I felt it's. I always ask artists to do, a sentence or a statement or sometimes a doodle. And then it became, a friend of mine said, it's a bit repetitive. It was actually, a bit repetitive, you know, but then I said at the same time, it's the movement is ongoing, you know, yes. It's not that we need to stop it because there still needs to be more handwriting and doodling. And then we were with Ben Vickers, the artist and writer and the CTO of the Serpentine, and in a conference actually, and Ben suddenly said out of the blue, why don't you do Exquisite Corpse, you know, because basically the surrealist tradition, it's this wonderful game. Breton wrote about it, and the surrealists did it all the time.
It was a parlor game, wasn't it?
Exactly, and you fold a piece of paper in 3-5 parts.
Yeah,
and
so then someone does the head, someone does the torso, someone does the legs. Yeah.
I love Exquisite Corpse.
And you can also do it with, you can do it, I think these are, the text. Thanks. And you can also do it with poems, as Agnes Varda showed me. One can write the poem. So it can be with drawing or with text.
Oh, so you complete the middle of the line.
Exactly.
So what's the structure for the poem if it's done in three sections?
Yeah, I mean, you basically said someone, you know, puts in a verb, someone puts in a, you know, there's a rule of the game, and then at the end it gives you a sentence.
Wow.
I think David Bowie would have loved that, because that was how he used to write his song lyrics. He used to cut up words and then, like, let them all be assembled. You know, he would, like, pick out words that he'd cut up, I think.
Well, like, collage them and then make
the lyrics. Kind of, yeah.
Really?
I think that's how he worked with his lyrics.
That's amazing. So
then we did Exquisite Corpse, and so that's now like an Instagram within my Instagram. It's like a, you know, and then about a year ago, maybe 6 months ago, I started to think questions that it would be somehow interesting to actually not only have statements and doodles and Exquisite Corpses, but actually have artists ask a question. And so now every day I post a question, and that, of course, has changed because then we get lots of answers. So today,
everyone's commenting on that, right?
Yeah, so today I saw Brian Eno, and he has got a really important question, which is about growth. What is it we want to be growing?
Okay. What do you think?
I mean, what he refers to, I think, is, of course, that the economy has followed for many years a sort of a paradigm of permanent growth and hasn't really taken into consideration care, but also the environment, and which is why we are, you know, in this ecological disaster the world is in. And so my professor, actually, because I studied economy and ecology, it was kind of the theme I studied at university, and my professor was this Swiss guru, Binswanger, and he early on, in the 70s, 80s, I studied with him in the late 80s, he said we need to bring in ecology into economy, and that would, of course, lead to certain limits of growth. You know, and not endless growth, because we need to consider the effect it has in terms of depletion of resources and the environment. So I do believe it has to do with certain theories of economy, what Prime means. And also, I mean, this very interesting book about the donut economy, which just came out. What's he mentioned? I'm going to read it now. Ordered it.
You can't tell us about the donut economy.
But Brian says we should all read it. So
okay, yeah. Brian Eno says this. All right,
so we're all going to go home and read The Donut Economy.
And actually, S. Devlin told me the same thing last week.
Oh, really?
So I'm definitely going to read this book.
Interesting.
Right.
Something that's always really fascinated me about you is your capacity for knowledge. And you, whenever I've heard you speak in public or in interviews, the amount of kind of reference points you can give and the kind of enthusiasm you have for other humans, and the way even just now you've mentioned so many different names from all different creative disciplines who are all completely remarkable people as well. Was that always something you had since you were a young child? Or because I'm quite fascinated in this idea of you as this famous person and as this celebrated curator and person that's helped so many artists. But but going back to you as the person and finding out, you know, how you've evolved into this incredible human that you are.
Yeah, so I kind of grew up in Switzerland. And, you know, when you grow up in Switzerland, you don't see the sea because the mountains, you know, block the view to the sea. And then also, like, I was somehow as a single child, you know,
You're an only child?
Yeah, and then as an only child, I felt a bit lonely sometimes in a small town in Switzerland. And so from very early on, I had a kind of an urge to connect and, you know, meet people. And so that had to do with that. But I think the whole idea of curiosity was really triggered because I always think it's very interesting what's the first place, the first museums we visit as a child, you know. And so for me, it was actually not the museum, it was a library.
Back
to books. And my parents took me when I was like 5 or something, they took me to the monastery library of St. Gallen, which is also the city where I then studied with, you know, this economist, Binswanger, who was early on into ecology. And St. Gallen has a very famous monastery in the Middle Ages. There's the famous cloister plan, the monastery plan from the 11th century. The monastery then burned down, but the library was saved and they rebuilt it during the age of the Rococo. So it has a very beautiful Rococo space with all these medieval, you know, manuscripts and handwritten books.
What year is Rococo? Is that still medieval times?
No, that was much later. Much later they rebuilt, you know,
In
the Rococo style, they built the library. But as they had saved the medieval books, you know, as a child I discovered these medieval books. And I remember always that first visit because my parents took me there and we had to get these felt shoes on so they're not to damage the floor.
Oh, wow.
So then you walk completely silently in the space in these felt shoes and one could actually make an appointment. And then when I sort of saw that you can make an appointment, I told my parents I want an appointment. So they made an appointment and then we went and one could actually with white gloves, you know, look at some of these books. So I have the memory of these gloves and of the felt shoes and of the silent walk and the time travel. You know, there's something for me as a child really impressive that I could touch something from 1100 or and then I sort of started to read about these monasteries and I was really fascinated by this idea that the monks wanted to know everything, you know, all the knowledge in the world. And I mean that's something which at that time, you know, it was always impossible, but at least maybe appeared to be possible. And of course, by the time I was born, it was an impossibility to know everything. But it sort of triggered my curiosity to kind of want to know everything, or the desire to want to know everything.
Wow.
And then I would say the other thing which was important about this experience was also the idea that I then read as a you know, later on when I was maybe 12 or something, I read about this because we went often back to this library and I read about the migrating monks who would live in a monastery, you know, accumulate all the knowledge and then go to the next monastery. So I thought as a teenager I could do the same with cities, you know, because by the time I was like 16 or 17, I became very obsessed by more contemporary art. I saw a Giacometti sculpture in Zurich, which is these long, thin figures of Giacometti, and I was really attracted to that. And
was it in a museum or was it?
It was like, in the Kunsthaus in a museum in Zurich.
Was it like a show of all of his work or was it one piece?
No, it was a whole room because the Kunsthaus Zurich has one of the biggest collections of Giacometti. And so they had early surrealist work and then his, you know, signature style with these long, thin figures. Yeah. But they also had paintings. But I was particularly attracted to these long, thin, almost immaterial figures. And then from there, I started to buy a lot of postcards. And with my pocket money, you know, my parents gave me, I would buy many, many, many art postcards. And I would start to go to all the museums and buy postcards of all my favorite paintings start to have this little museum in my room, you know, at my parents' house, where I would curate first exhibitions.
No way! Wouldn't you put different postcards up and make different shows?
Yeah.
That is amazing.
That's kind of how it began.
That's awesome.
Love.
Have you still got the postcards?
Yeah, they're at my mother's home.
Are they?
Wow.
So how many do you think you've got?
Maybe 1,000.
Do you still collect them now?
No, I stopped collecting postcards when I went to university. When I went to university, really, because that kind of postcard museum was then accomplished. And then I actually started to curate exhibitions, real exhibitions, you know, in my student apartment. But before that, there were these migrating years.
You had your first show in your apartment, didn't you?
In the kitchen, yeah.
Kitchen of your apartment. Yeah.
But that took quite some time because I was sort of between 16, 17 and 21, 22 when I started then to do my apartment exhibitions. I went on these endless train journeys because I realized that as a student in Europe, you can buy these tickets, these interrail tickets.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
And for very little money, you can just travel in the European railway network for an entire month. And so I had no money for hotels, but I found out this methodology basically travel plan that I could just go from city to city and always sleep on the night train. And then I didn't need a hotel and the train was for free.
Wow.
So I would do 30 cities in 30 days in Europe. I would go from Vienna.
Phileas Fogg.
Something.
Around the world in 80 days.
Exactly, around Europe. It was always a very European channel because I didn't have money to go beyond that. So it was always at the European train network. And then, you know, I sort of would stay in a city and make studio visits, but I had to go to the next city in order to kind of spend the night on the train. But I would then come back. So I would often do back and forth because I needed to go several times.
What years was this?
87, 89. And so it's obviously before the World Wide Web.
Yeah. Because how Tim did you Berners-Lee, organize studio visits then with these people? How did you get in contact with
there
them?
There was this book called The Art Diary, which was published by Flash Art. And it was kind of a book where you just had all the telephone numbers. The artwork was much smaller then.
What, of the artists?
You had artists, curators, museum directors, institutions, and galleries for each city.
Wow, that's so cool.
Because the artwork was just smaller then. You know, that's kind of unthinkable now. It was much smaller. And so then, of course, you know, I would always find a way to find people. And even if the often well-known artist number would not be in this book, but then I would have a friend who would introduce me to a friend. And it was really, you know, Fish Lee Weiss, the Swiss artist, became who did this poster, How to Work Better.
I know, I saw it's that when poster. I came in.
That's in New York, isn't it, at the moment? They had it up on the wall, a mural there.
They did it as a mural. It's do one thing at a time. It's number one, two, know the problem. Three, learn to listen. Four, learn to ask questions. Five, distinguish sense from nonsense. Six, accept change as inevitable. Seven, admit mistakes. Eight, say it simple. Nine, be calm. And 10, smile. And so I was in their studio with number 17, and they did this chain reaction, their famous film, The Way Things Go.
Yes.
And then,
like a domino effect going through.
Domino, yeah. And I was really impressed as a teenager to see that process of the film. And that's really when I decided that I wanted to become a curator and work with artists.
And they were in your first show, weren't they, in the kitchen show?
They were in the kitchen show.
Which I love, because I think they're pretty much up there as my pinnacle of
heroes.
What I think is great
what
in art.
What was the work that they showed in your kitchen?
They did because they had also the idea for my kitchen show together with Christian Boltanski. They saw that always, wherever I am, like in this office, there are lots of books. Mm. And because I just had always to be surrounded by books. And then the kitchen was also full of books. And they felt it's kind of weird that they're in this student apartment, and, you know, I never cooked. So I would always go to a coffee shop for breakfast, and I would never cook. And so they felt, you know, we kind of need to make this kitchen a kitchen. Right. And we need to evacuate the book. And so that was the idea of the show. It was kind of brilliant. A joke. They said, this is kind of not normal that even the kitchen is a library. They kind of need to make this a normal apartment. So we get these books out of the kitchen and bring in food. So they ordered these huge quantities of food for restaurants, you know, because restaurants would not order a small, basically, quantity of noodles or tomato sauce or, you know, chocolate pudding or whatever. But, you know, all these things you could buy in tins or, you know, also dried like noodles and stuff, would be instead of 200 grams or 500 grams, it would be 5 kilograms or 10 kilograms, like huge packages for restaurant supply. And so they would order these very big, you know, tins and bags and sort of fill it or fit it into the kitchen. And that means, of course, it looked very strange, because it's almost like when, as a child, small things appear quite big to you because you're small.
Yeah.
And then as a child, and then when you grow up, suddenly these things don't appear so giant anymore. So it was this weird memory of childhood, because suddenly you saw, you know, a tin, or you saw a package of noodle, but it was far too big in the kitchen, and you thought, like, wow, and you sort of became almost a child again.
Who does that with furniture? Robert Therion. Is that how you say his name?
You mean the giant ones?
He does, like, the giant chairs.
I saw one in Hampstead Heath once.
The giant chairs and table, and he's died recently.
I did a long interview with him Robert Therion, and he very sadly passed away.
But I made
a studio visit with him, and he was actually very, very moving, because when we went to the studio, in his studio, it was like a house. And so to see some of these objects, including the table, not in a museum, but in a house.
Oh, wow.
So a domestic situation.
Yeah,
wow.
So I really hope. Also, the cupboard was filled with these oversized items. And I really hope that his studio house will become a museum. Because it's in Los Angeles.
Right.
And I really hope they make it, they transform it into a museum. Because it's a beautiful house museum. It could become like a bit like the Sir John Soane's house of LA.
Brilliant.
It makes me think of Martin Creed as well. Like, you remember, we interviewed Martin Creed for the podcast, and he has the Neon Mothers that was at the Hayward Gallery. And I was saying it's like the Muppet Babies, where the Muppet Babies only see the legs, and it's like the Mothers is this huge thing. Yeah. So it makes you feel like a child again.
And I heard that one of the earliest things that sort of encouraged you to get into art was from reading again. But you were reading interviews where artists would talk to other people. So maybe David Sylvester and Francis Bacon, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And can you mention that and how that kind of inspired you? Because obviously interviews have become such a big part of your life.
And this is an ongoing thing, as well as getting the artist to give you a sentence, a poetic sentence or a question. The interviews for you is a thing that you've got a lifelong commitment to.
Yeah, there are about 3,000 hours now. And it's definitely, you know, a growing archive, because it's either way the memory of my encounters. And as you say, you know, reading conversations with artists triggered that, because before I started to actually meet artists, and before, when I was 17, I then had the courage to just bring up Fish Levice and say, you know, I'm a teenager, I love your work, can I visit? And obviously, because I was so young, people were very open. And but before I had this courage to do so, I was too shy for a couple of years to do it. But between sort of 15 and 17, I would read all these conversations with artists, and through that grew the desire to meet the artists. So yeah, absolutely. As you say, I would read the many conversations David Sylvester had with Francis Bacon, and then I thought, like, wow, you know, one can have a lifelong conversation with an artist, not just do one conversation, but go deeper and deeper. And that became somehow a thing I'm also doing, because I talk to artists not only once, but again and again. And then I would say another book, which was really important also in that regard, was, of course, these interviews with, or conversations with, I don't know if I have it here, with Goethe, you know, because there is this this interview book with the German writer Goethe, and more than 200 years ago, and I read that, and then also Brassai with Picasso, I remember. And then, you know, all of a sudden, after having read all these conversations with artists, I just had an incredible urge to meet the artists. And that's how these studio visits then started. The first artist was Claude Sandu, who is a Swiss artist in Luzern. I just saw a show of his in St. Gallen, and I, you know, in a Kunstverein, and I said, I really have to meet this artist. So they gave me the telephone number, and I would ring him up. And then from there, it went to Fish Levice. And then Fish Levice, it also became a chain reaction, because the artist would then say, wow, you know, you should meet our friend X or Y or Z.
Yeah.
So Fish Levice sent me to H.R. Giger. So that became one of the very early studio visits. The artist who invented Alien, a true Alien.
Wow.
And then...
Well, that's quite typical of their work, for them to do that chain reaction then, isn't it? Yeah.
The chain reaction became a chain reaction in my life.
Wow.
And then they also connected me to Jeff Koons and Alighiero Boetti. So I went, because we went, at that time I was still at the Lyceum, at high school, and so we went on a school trip to Rome, and Fish Levice said, you know, in case you're bored on the school trip, you should ring up our friend
Boetti.
Alighiero Boetti. And
wow.
then he, that was really a very important day, because he spent the day with me, and he basically said, you know, if you want to become a curator, you should not do what curators often do, which means like squeeze artists into a box, you know, because he says, I was always called an arte povera artist, but I'm not, you know, I'm an artist and I'm not part of a box. Mm. And you should not put people in a box, but also you should listen, this idea of listening, you know, and one should not come with a predetermined idea, but actually listen to what artists really want to do. Because he says he's always invited to do the same thing, like group shows in biennales, or sometimes, you know, to do a gallery show or a museum show.
Is he still alive?
No, he passed away about 20 years ago. And then he said, you know, you should just, he said, I give you an advice. You just should ask the artist about their dream, about their unrealized project. Stuff they cannot do within the existing structure of museums and galleries and art fairs and biennales, and then you should try to help them to do that. And then I went back on the train and I told Fish Levice. So you see, so it became that kind of thing, because it was almost like the internet before the internet, because in a way there wasn't an internet, but I would go to these cities and have many, many encounters, learn a lot, and then go to the next city and tell the artists I met there, and the curators and the writers and the philosophers whom I had met, and so it became that chain reaction also of knowledge, which is not so different from what I had read earlier about what the monk did in the Middle Ages. You know, they would basically be in a monastery, learn all the knowledge, and then they would be migrating monks. So I saw myself as a kind of a migrating monk. It was faster than in the Middle Ages because I had the night trains. Mm-hmm. And then soon after Boetti, also through Fish Levice, I met Rosemary Trockel, so when I was 17. And so I went to Cologne, and that became another really crucial meeting for me, which has a lot to do actually what's happening this summer at the Serpentine with Lucita Hurtado and Faith Ringgold.
You
know, neither of these two shows would ever have happened without me meeting, you know, Rosemary Trockel in 85, because I went to see Rosemary and we talked about her work, and she again, like Boetti, gave me a very deep sort of advice, because she says there is the thing, you know, at that time Louis Bourgeois just started to become famous, and obviously Louise Bourgeois was already in her 70s, 80s then, and was recognized very, very late in her life. Mm-hmm. She had exhibited much earlier, but the recognition came very late. And so Rosemary said, you know, as happy as I am for Louise to finally have the recognition she deserves, as upsetting it is that there are so many extraordinary women artists, you know, all over the world, like Louise Bourgeois, who are not being recognized. And she says, one should just go from city to city and ask in every city, you know, who is a Louise Bourgeois figure, who is a pioneering artist one needs to revisit. And she says, you should not only, because I always would look at young emerging artists, it was always also about supporting artists at the beginning of their trajectory. She said, you should not only do that, you should also look back, because there is amnesia and certain artists need a rediscovery. And so I was, you know, and she said, but I'm an artist, I can't do that. You know, my work is to be an artist, but you're a young curator, you have time, just go to all these cities. And then again, I would just do it. I would go from city to city, and, you know, that's how, and I would still do it. You know, whenever I'm in a city, I ask, is there a pioneering artist? And that's how a few years ago, you know, Bettina Korek told me about Luchita Hurtado, and we went to the studio in LA, and she's now 98 and has been painting since the 30s. And,
yeah, amazing.
And was friends with Duchamp, and of course, you know, from the very beginning felt that she had a responsibility to the world, to the planet. She's was one of the very early artists working with ecology. She also was part of, the, in the 60s already, of the feminist movement. Earlier on, she was connected to surrealism. Right. Never part of a movement, always very autonomous. Again, you know, not in a box, a very free thinker.
But she did never... she know Max Ernst and Dorothea Tanning and people like that?
Yeah, very well. And she was married to Wolfgang Pahlen, one of the surrealists, one of the Austrian surrealists. Not only did she know them, she was friends with all the surrealists and part in Mexico, you know, of this exile community of surrealism then, and then part of the, after the war in San Francisco, of the avant-garde movements there. And so, you know, she had never had a show at that time, and still until today, until the Serpentine, has not had a museum show.
Wow.
So,
but did you say, you take in Boetti's advice, did you go to her and ask her, what is your dream that's not been realized?
We did. And she basically said, you know, that of course, at 98, she has more than 70 years of work. I mean, some works are from the 1930s. So she said, the dream is, of course, to see it once all together, you know? And wow. So. And because she always said she knew one day her time would come and to see it all together. So then I said, you know, let's do a retrospective.
Wow.
And this is an ongoing story that we're hearing more and more and more with lots of different artists. And you mentioned also Faith Ringgold.
Yeah.
And it's a very similar case with Faith, where Faith was making work for decades, you know, for herself. But with the idea that one day we would all catch up with her and with what she was trying to say. And she had such a clear vision. And I'm so inspired by Faith, particularly this week. I've spent a lot of time thinking about her, thanks to this show.
Did you see the film also?
Yeah, it's just incredible. And I'm actually so deeply touched by it. And I'm so grateful that she exists and that she had that perseverance and strength of character to make art, because she had no choice. But, you know, she was so... It was just brilliant. The whole story is so brilliant. But equally, the work is so brilliant. And I'm really happy that, you know, you and Melissa Blanchflower and the whole team here have put on this incredible exhibition that I think is actually, you know, doing something to make positive change in the world. And that's what, for me, art is about. And I think, you know, it's probably why you've got into art too. But talk about Faith as well. So how did you first meet her?
No, I'm so happy I'm so happy you liked the show. And we felt it's a very urgent show. And with Melissa and our team, in a similar way as with, you know, Rebecca Lewin, you know, we curated the Faith show. It's the same with Faith, that there just has never been a survey of her work in Europe. And her work is so influential. She was born in 1930 in Harlem, was part of the Harlem Renaissance. I mean, she grew up with people like Jacob Lawrence, Duke Ellington, you know, living in the neighborhood, being friends with the parents. And then very early on studied art and has created these amazing, amazing bodies of work. I mean, the work in the 60s, of course, is part of the civil rights movement. It's a really history painting she created, but at that time, you know, was not exhibited a lot. And of course, she, as opposed to Luchita, who never had a show, Faith did have exhibitions all over the United States, but she just never had these museum surveys, which I think she deserves and which are very important, and certainly never in Europe. And she's been also a curator, because she basically was involved in the National Black Feminist Organization in 73 with her then 18-year-old daughter Michelle Ballas, has also curated exhibitions, so activism was always a part of that. And it's just this do-it-yourself spirit, which is in the work, which I think gives us courage. I think the important thing is, in this very complicated world, is to, you know, to have courage that we can make a difference, that everyone can make a difference to the planet. And so I think and that's something why art is so important. I think we need art more than ever before. The world needs art more than ever before now in the 21st
century.
To connect
people.
Yeah. And to give us courage. I think that idea of the immense, I mean, I get immense courage from Faith to continue. So and I hope our viewers and visitors do as well, because I think she gives us that. I mean, as she says, you know, we can fly. It's empowering. And we can fly if, you know, only we, if only we try. And I mean, a great story is also, she then did, after the American People series, she did whole, you know, other series which were basically always about a more diverse world, which were about, you know, also about her voice, you know, getting out there. And she, even at the moment when the art world did not somehow recognize the work, she always find a way, in a DIY way, to actually create this visibility. And she told us this wonderful story that she wrote her memoirs and the publisher turned her down and wanted to change her story. So she says that's outrageous. Because
wants
of
to
course,
change her story.
Yeah. So it's like censorship, right? And so then she felt, you know, that is my story. Yeah. I want to tell my story. I'm not going to tell it differently.
Yeah.
So they had a falling out with the publisher. And then she thought, how can she publish the story anyhow? So then she came up with this amazing idea that she could just write it on quilts. So it became basically the book becomes a painting. Wow. And that's what you can see in the show, her quilts. Yeah. And it's also fascinating because in a way, people spend a lot of time in the exhibition and some people look at painting, but some people read.
Yeah.
It's like in a library.
It's autobiographical completely.
And it's both. It's both a painting and a book. And then, of course, the amazing thing happened that she did these quilts where she brought together personal stories and also the history of African Americans. Basically, she it's a story which was passed on to her by her great great grandmother Susie Shannon, who was born into slavery. And basically, it's about memory. It's very much about memory. And I think, you know, it's important memory, as Faith is telling us, because we live in an age. Again, I mean, this year is the 30th anniversary of the World Wide Web, which Tim Berners-Lee invented in 1989. And we, of course, today have more information than ever before. But that does not necessarily mean that we have more memory. Maybe.
How do you cope with that? Because you want to know everything. So the fact that you've got as much information as you can get, you must go insane. How do you slow that down? How do you stop yourself?
Yeah, I mean, by de-linking. You know, there are always moments when, I mean, when I have conversations, when I make studio visits, I de-link and I don't look at the phone and
so you slow
I put
down.
It on airplane mode. It's you know, it's I'm offline. I go offline. I think de-linking. There are moments of linking and moments of de-linking.
Okay.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But that idea of memory, quickly going back to that, it's so powerful because, like you say, these days, yes, we've got all this access to endless knowledge, but we're not always clear where that knowledge is coming from or who's writing what we're reading and, you know, what the actual truth of things is. If you think of fake news and all the stuff going on, you know, the American politics or what have you. But even in China, you know, there's kind of erasures of history and different religions and different cultures still to this day. Like right now it's happening.
But I think it's also got to do with a show I've actually curated this year with posters, which is called It's Urgent. Because there's so many, you know, issues in the world and the way how artists can tell us about them and can actually also translate them and create a conversation around them. And I think we need we need these conversations. And I think so we've done an exhibition. It was at the moment of the European election on May 26th. So it happened in Denmark on all the billboards. And so all over the country, I curated billboards. And that has now become a traveling exhibition. It's at the moment in the Westbau in Zurich and then going to go around the world, where many artists are doing posters and billboards.
That hasn't been in London yet, though.
No, not yet. And the idea is that basically we are asking artists, you know, what is urgent? Because I feel art today is more urgent than ever before, but I, you know, I want to listen to artists, what they think is urgent.
Yes.
And this idea, again, of listening. I think it's important to listen also. The quality of listening is a very important thing in in the 21st century. So anyway, that's a billboard show, and that of course means also that we go with art, you know, to the people, that we go with art into society. And I think that's a very important thing for now. I mean, the other day I came back from a trip very early, and like at 6 a.m. and the taxi driver dropped me because I went straight to the office, and obviously he'd assumed that I would work here because no one would visit the park or the Serpentine at 6-7 a.m. So he said he always wanted to meet someone from the Serpentines. I said, you know, delighted that he wanted to tell me a story. And so the story is basically that he came to the park a few months ago with his daughter, teenage daughter, and all of a sudden the daughter ran into the pavilion. And then he had to find her and continue the walk. And, you know, and he said she had some revelation. Because ever since, she only wants to read architecture book, and she now wants to study architecture. And
they're
inspired by Zaha Hadid and wants to become the next Zaha Hadid.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
And then I was very touched, because I think that's why...
How long ago was the Zaha Hadid pavilion?
Yeah, it wasn't... She didn't see the Zaha pavilion.
Okay, no.
But she actually saw one of the more recent pavilions. Yeah, yeah. But then through that, got into architecture, and now, you know, became obsessed by Zaha Hadid, because of course... You know, it's for her an inspiration, also as a pioneering woman architect. Who has had such an influence and continues to resonate. And then I was kind of thinking, you know, I was very touched, because that's why I get out of bed every morning. But then the second part of the story is really why I'm telling you the story, because then I ask him, you know, if they had also visited the gallery, because it's free admission, because we have free admission here for everyone, for more than 1 million people a year. And he said no, and I said why, and there was a science. And then he said, actually, after the debate, he said, if he really is thinking about it, he knows what to answer, because he really thinks that, you know, museums are not for people like him. And, you know, and there is still this threshold that for certain people, they just wouldn't come to a museum. And I think it's very important that we address that.
Yes.
And that we
totally
go. And that's why the pavilion, you know, has no doors. That's why we do public art. We now have the Jakob Kutz-Dinsen, which is our first virtual pavilion, which is an augmented architecture collaboration with Google Arts and Culture. And that's done, of course, because we have at the Serpentine now a chief technology officer with Ben Vickers. We have a digital curator with Kay Watson, a whole digital department. And the idea is that has become a very important part of what we do. Mm-hmm. And so in addition to the Ishigami Pavilion this year, which again is very open, there are no doors, there is also the Digital Pavilion. And the Digital Pavilion is an augmented architecture pavilion, which has to do with ecology, with nature, where we can experience invisible aspects of the park. We can basically experience the bats. We don't see the bats during the day.
Wow.
We can experience many trees. It's a deep listening to the park and makes the invisible park in a way visible. And so that idea, you know, that it creates an interface digitally, but also in an analog way with the pavilion, with public art, means that we have to go outside our space. And that's also why we now go to Barking Dagenham and have a collaboration with the leader of Barking Dagenham and the community there. And our whole education project, part of that is happening there. Projects are going to happen there.
Why Barking and Dagenham?
Because they basically had an open call, and they invited several institutions to make proposals of what could happen there. And we participated in that because we felt it's very important.
Yeah.
You know, because also you have so many
people. I went to college in Barking.
That's incredible.
I went to Barking College, yeah.
Wow, because so many people have actually told us that, you know, that a percentage, an important percentage of teenagers who grew up in Barking Dagenham have never been to London. So they obviously have never been to the Serpentine.
Wow.
And so it's important that we can go there, programs. Yeah.
And haven't you done that recently as well in Peckham? Didn't you do an off-site like pavilion or something?
Yeah, we do.
With Arthur Jaffa or something?
With Arthur Jaffa. The Arthur Jaffa idea was that he, because he said the same thing when we had Arthur Jaffa, he wanted to use his exhibition to bring in many voices. That's also interesting in relation to technology, because he said there are all these artists who work on Instagram and YouTube and they're not to be seen in the gallery space. Yeah. So through his exhibition, he brought in Frida Oropedo, who never had exhibited in a gallery. She was only on Instagram and brought her into the gallery space. But then he says...
She and Simon Gavin Brown. That's who, Gavin Brown Enterprise. Yeah. Right. So she signed after he got her...
The first show she ever had in an exhibition space outside Instagram was through Arthur Jaffa, because he said we have to bring practices, because there's so many practices which are not part necessarily of the museum or gallery network,
right?
And it's important, as Arthur Jaffa says, that we look at those practices and can bring them into the world of museums. But then he said we need to also do the other movement, which means we need to go with the work into society, and that's why he refused to show Love is the Message, one of his main works, in the Serpentine show. And he said, he wanted to build a tent and have it in different neighborhoods. And, we didn't get planning permission everywhere because it needed planning permission. But ideally, it would have been shown in many, many different neighborhoods. But it did ultimately go outside the gallery.
That's so brilliant. And he's really great as well, because he's thinking of different mediums and bringing them all together. And I think that idea of togetherness is such a powerful kind of, thing for us all to be thinking about and stop being so isolationist or whatever.
So we have an office really now in Barking Dagenham, and our, curator, amazing, Amal Khalaf, is there, and so the Serpentine in this year, and then particularly in 2020, is in Kensington Gardens and in Barking Dagenham.
Wow. We have to go. That is so cool.
Yeah.
So we could do a meeting there.
I'm going to go back to Barking.
We can do a meeting there with you. It'd be great.
Let's do it. Let's do a Barking meeting.
I love that.
What's the proudest show you've had here for you?
There are many exhibitions I could mention. It's always difficult to pick out one. I mean, for me, of all the shows I've done or curated, Maybe Do It is, which is still ongoing, is the exhibition I'm happiest with, because it never ended, and it's still ongoing. We started it in 93, so it's been touring for 26 years.
So cool.
What's non-stop. This show? What, Do It? This
Do It, yeah. So it's basically a show where I invited artists to write an instruction, a how-to manual. It's kind of a DIY idea.
Right.
And then it can be interpreted. So... it's not a transport, doesn't involve crates, people can just do it, it's open source, and so it's been realized in more than 160 museums, in art schools, in colleges, in all kinds of different contexts.
So where do you get this manual from?
We did it. That was the work, the curatorial work, is to invite artists. I've invited about 200 artists to write an instruction piece.
Yeah, where do you get the instruction piece from, though? Is it a physical...
The artists write it.
They wrote it.
We so invited. You asked them to write a DIY manual kind of idea. Like, that's the invitation.
Yeah.
And the artist will write whatever it is, what the instructions are.
It's seen a similar way, with my Instagram, the artist would write...
So it's like a treasure hunt type thing, or what? What is it like?
No, it's a very open... It's like an open score. It's more like in music. When you have a musical score can be played in different places. You don't need to ship anything. You just download the score and then you play it. And so in a way, the idea was to apply that to an exhibition so that these instructions can be realized. And some of these instructions have been realized now many, many, many times. And each time it's different because it's locally interpreted different. And what makes me very happy with this project is it's now part in New York of some school curriculum.
So cool.
In some high school, it's part of the curriculum that students basically realize a Franz West Pastuk or a Louis Bourgeois. Louis Bourgeois invites us to go into the city and to smile. So it's not only, objects, it's sometimes also things.
But is there a database somewhere of every artist that's contributed?
Yeah, we have an archive. Books have been published. Okay. And then it's also online on eFlux. And the ICI has been touring it through universities, independent curator in corporate. It was in the Manchester International Festival a few years ago. We did a retrospective. And that show is a great inspiration of what we want to do now also at the Serpentine with ecology. Because for us, I think it's very important when the Serpentine turns 50, because next year we are 50. And so it's 1970 and then 2020. So we've been thinking, of course, it's important to remember the past and have an online archive of all the shows and all the projects. But more importantly, we wanted to look into the future. And so we thought it's important to think about 2070, what are the next 50 years? And And we live in an age of mass extinction, of massive ecological disasters, and a mass extinction not only of species, about a million species are threatened, but also
us,
mm-hmm. and also a mass extinction of cultural phenomenon, languages disappear. So we want to make that very much the theme of the Serpentine 2020, in a way how to actually fight extinction, but how also in a way make ecology very center stage, which is why now also we have with Lucia Pietro-Justi, a curator of ecology, and that we have the General Ecology Project, the whole department. And of course that sort of whole idea of Do It is inspiring in relation to that. So how an exhibition can be more than just a one-off thing, you know, that it's, because if you think about ecology and about extinction, that's not something which is going to be done in 2020. We need to do this for the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And that means it should be a project which is going to continue to evolve. And that idea of Do It is that it's an exhibition which never stopped.
Wow.
And actually, you've been someone quite uniquely in a way that has always been quite aware of trying to bring together science and art and the power of bringing those things together. I think you've been interested in that quite early on, haven't you?
Yeah, I did some projects actually in the 90s about art and science. And I always felt that it's important that we go beyond. I mean, in any case, I became a curator also because of Diaghilev. That I forgot to mention at the beginning, because you asked me about the beginnings. One thing which was also crucial was that as a teenager, I came across a book of the Russian impresario Diaghilev. And he was a painting curator and then had this epiphany that he could bring together all the disciplines through the Ballet Russe. So he would do the Ballet Russe, the Rite of Spring, and you know he would bring together Stravinsky, who would do the sound, mm-hmm. these amazing dancers and choreographers with whom he worked. He'd have Picasso or Goncharova do the stage sets and create this kind of Gesamtkunstwerk through ballet. And that for me was a huge inspiration that we bring through the medium of the exhibition the disciplines together. And then later, of course, it also became clear to me that we can only address the big topics of the 21st century, some of which I've mentioned, like extinction, ecology, inequality, that we can only address that if we come out from our silos, if we don't stay within silos, that everybody needs in that sense to collaborate, to cooperate.
Silence, did you say?
Silo?
What's that?
Silo.
How do you call it in English? It's the silo, when S-I-L-O.
No idea.
It's a structure for storing bulk materials. Silos are used in agriculture to store grain.
Okay. Oh, like a...
Yeah, they're like these kind of...
Like a barn.
Kind of, yeah. But
a storage vessel thing.
Yeah, so these are silos.
Right.
And if you think about knowledge, you know, it's divided into these silos.
Yeah.
So we need to break through this and connect.
Yeah.
And so if that's why the image is sort of...
So it's just about segregation, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Keeping a thing segregated, okay.
To go beyond the fear also of pooling knowledge, which is a fear to go into other fields, one wouldn't understand. And so particularly, you know, and it, of course, has to happen with art also, that, you know, we connect the forces of visual arts. We can only understand if we understand what's happening in music, in literature, in theatre, in film. In architecture and design, which what we're doing here, but one has to go further than that, because there is a kind of a divide of two cultures, that sort of a two-culture divide between the humanities and science. And I always felt that we need to bridge that gap. And so in the 90s, I did some conferences which tried to do that. Like we did a conference called Art and Brain, where we invited artists to Germany's biggest science center in Jülich. And it was announced as a big conference, but the day when everybody arrived, I decided that we cancel the conference and that it's just a coffee break. So everybody just had a chat and a lot of things happened because people got to know each other and they didn't just deliver what they had prepared. Yeah. But
people freak out when you first did that, where they're like, what? You can't do this. You can't do this.
Yeah, it was a bit of an anxiety, but then at the same time, people really embraced it and they had lots of conversation. And then we did the show Laboratorium. The book is there, you know, and... that was basically also about art and science in 1999 in Antwerpen, where we brought together with Barbara van der Linden, you know, many scientists, artists, to talk about the studio and the laboratory. And we visited scientific labs with the visitors. We asked artists to install labs in the museum. We visited artist studios. So, and was this idea, how can an exhibition be a laboratory of new ideas? So, yeah, it's always been there, that connection to science.
It's so unique, that, though, I think. And it's brilliant that you were able to make that kind of part of your mission, in a way, and to bring different disciplines together. Mm. And One thing I've loved that you've done as well was A Brief History of Curating. I just want to quickly mention this because it is so important because you are obviously a curator. And when I think about Serpentine, you know, I thought when we were coming to meet you, I was trying to think of shows that have had a long-lasting impact on me. And I'd say 90% of them were women, apart from Gustav Metzger, because that show was incredible exhibition. But, you know, Rebecca Warren, Phyllida Barlow, there's just so many.
Rose Wiley,
Helen Martin, like all these exhibitions. And you've actually shown such a large number of women. So being a curator obviously comes with a lot of responsibility, and you have to sort of, you know, like you say, listen. And I think it was so great that you realised as well that there wasn't really much of a document about what being a curator is and the history of it all. So it's great that you made that book.
Yeah, I thought always in a way that it was very strange when I kind of started. Everybody always said, you know, does it come from Harald Seemann? And of course, you know, Harald Seemann is the legendary Swiss curator, and he was an influence. But I mean, there are so many more curators who were somehow doing incredible work in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, whom I met.
And they weren't recognized.
And they weren't really recognized. And so I felt it's kind of important to write this history. Or at least, I mean, one can never write the entire history, but make a small contribution maybe to write that history. And so I did.
And you've written yourself in there.
Not really. No, I was mostly listening.
Right. Yeah. No, but he doesn't need to write himself in there. He wrote the book.
Yeah. But in a way, I was mostly listening to their history, to these different histories. I mean, and also just it's a way of recognizing, you know, the people from whom I was inspired. And for example, Lucy Lippert. You know, Lucy Lippert is so relevant now because, I mean, she is not only one of the key figures of conceptual art and curated exhibitions with postcards, with instructions, you know, so Do It came from her.
Wow.
But also, she early on understood the importance of ecology and, you know, moved to the countryside and started to work in very rural
settings. So where is she from?
She's from the US. And right. She now lives in New Mexico. She was part of the New York art world and then decided to move to New Mexico and really works, you know, in very rural contexts, works with topics of ecology, environment, land art, but environmental art very early on. Like Agnes Denes is an artist who worked early on with land, you know, art, but from a very ecological point of view. And so someone like Lucy Lippert just felt incredibly important. So I wanted to record her voice. And then, of course, also people like Walter Hobbs, no, who the American curator. And so that generation, they were all still, I mean, Lucy Lippert is still alive and working, but many of them are no longer working. I mean, Anne Darnoncourt died and also Walter Hobbs died. So it was a moment to just kind of record these voices and recognize them. And that became Brief History of Curating. And then I was always asked to write a book. And I thought in a way that book could somehow be, and we did this together with Asad Raza, could be a book. And that became Ways of Curating, where I kind of tell my story, but through the people I met, you know? And so in that sense, it's a book, you know, about my life, but it's actually mainly a book about the people whom I love and admire.
You're inspired by.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing.
That's so great. Thanks. I also think about things like Yoko Ono when I think of you. I don't know why, but I saw her show here and I love the positive messages that she has for the world and that her and John Lennon like had when he was alive as well. Like, the kind of simplicity of the way that she can communicate in such a powerful and positive kind of hopeful way. Yeah. And she also Marina Abramovic, because I came to that exhibition here and I remember her taking me by the hand.
She took you by the hand, you had that experience.
Exactly, but that exhibition as well. And there's these artists who have such powerful
Another
messages
woman.
In such a direct way of communicating. Yeah. And I think you yourself are able to somehow, you know, put on those kind of shows.
Yeah,
I think it's exciting also in a way that the idea of the solo show, you know, the idea that actually, because the Serpentine, and in that sense, it's really for many artists a perfect building, because it's in a park and there are always trees and I think, I mean, Etel Anan once said, a day without seeing a tree is a wasted day, and I think Agnes Varda said something similar, and I always have to see trees, and so I think artists love this idea that, you know, we're here with trees in the park, but also, when they do a show here, they have the whole building. You know, it's not that there is
a room.
Yeah, or any other shows next to it. Yeah. It's not like a kind of a mixed situation where the artist is alongside a collection and other artists and a restaurant and a cafe and a theater. It's just a Gesamtkunstwerk. The artist can take over the building. And that, of course, can lead to a lot of different gestures. You know, Matthew Barney would not only climb the walls and do one of his drawing restraint, but he would decide that the doors have to be open. Then Trisha Donnelly decided that she wanted actually the doors not only to be slightly open, but completely open, so that people could come from the park, and she would basically create a sound installation so that people could hear the sound from outside and walk in and come and check out what it was. And then at the same time, you know, you have Marina Abramović, who came up with a different, the show you saw, which came up with a very different rule of the game, because she basically wanted us to hand over the keys. So we handed over the keys of the gallery. She came here every morning, opened the gallery, literally took over, and created this situation. People had to leave their phone and had to really de-link and then be in silence and somehow follow her, follow her instructions, but also follow the experience where they would fall asleep. They might also have an experience in the gallery they never had before. Many people came back very, very regularly. Some people came every day during that show. So I think that idea, you know, that the artist can take over the entire building and literally get the keys in a metaphorical, or in Marina's case, in the real sense, is part of it.
I guess that is part of the dream, in a way, because they're getting to create a complete universe somehow.
And people can then enter the world. I mean, like, even like with virtual work, like with Ian Cheng, when it was the first AI show we did here.
I love that show.
And Bob, became the world of Bob. So to be with Bob is all we ask, and it's a Bob world after all. And so people came here and they could be with Bob. And it's the first artwork they might have encountered with a nervous system.
Yeah.
We're currently working with a magazine called Hunger, and we're looking at sound art.
Yeah.
Is there sound art that you've had in your exhibitions before, that, or artists that you respect who work with sound?
Yeah, I mean, we always explore sound as a very important dimension, I would say, in the work. I mean, we just did basically an ecology conference, which Lucia Pietro Justi curated, which we will get you the text afterwards, where sound played a very central role. We have a lot of park night programming. So the park nights, which we curate with Claude Agil, they happen in the pavilion. And the idea is that the pavilion is almost like used as a musical instrument. So we always, on Friday nights, invite a musician, a composer, a visual artist, a fashion designer, to actually do something with a poet, with the pavilion, and play that pavilion. And so that's, we're working with several, you know, musicians and composers to do that. Albert Erland's exhibition, which is coming up in October, where Albert will create a kind of a new Rothko chapel. In the Serpentine, it would be very different from the Rothko chapel, but it's his idea of a chapel.
Oh, cool.
And the Rothko chapel, of course, is silent. Sometimes they play Martin Fellman's piece of music he made, but that happens only every couple of years. Whilst the chapel here will have sound, and he's programming bands and electronic music.
Oh, amazing.
In relation. So that's an aspect of sound. And then we're working, of course, on a big project with Brian Eno. Because Brian Eno is one of the great pioneers of sound in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also our neighbor. I often go on walks with him because he lives on the other side of the park. And he's been very often part of our marathons, which are the knowledge festivals. We do these marathons always around the theme, where we bring together 50 practitioners and, you know, to talk, perform. And Brian did a lot of performances as part of the marathon. But we realized that there had never been a bigger exhibition in London with Brian. So we feel it will be very exciting in 2020.
That's great. Brian Eno project. Yes. That's really important, because he is totally genius. Yeah.
So there is a lot with sound.
So we ask all of our guests two questions, which you probably know of, because you said you've listened to Talk Art. They're very, very hard. Our first question is, if you were to perform an art heist, if you were to steal a touchstone artwork that you could take away anywhere in the world and take it home to be with you forever, what would that be?
Yeah, I will answer that at the end, because I still haven't come to a conclusion what it should be. Because I believe I'd rather have this artwork on public display for
You're
many
so
people.
You're so generous.
To see it.
That's lovely of you.
I mean, that's kind of my answer. I wouldn't.
You've got to be selfish.
I wouldn't want to kidnap an artwork, because I'd rather, you know, all my favorite artworks, I think, should be there for everyone. I mean, Tim Berners-Lee says, when he invented the World Wide Web in 1989. This is for everyone. It was also the motto, the slogan, when he performed in the London Olympic ceremony. And, you know, now we celebrated all the 30th anniversary of the World Wide Web in March 2019. And, of course, Tim Berners-Lee is extremely worried, because net neutrality is endangered. And he really does not want net neutrality to go away. Together with Rosemary Lee, they have a foundation to save net neutrality. And of course, the loss of net neutrality would mean that there is a fast internet for people who pay and the slow internet for people who don't pay. Right. So he says, you know, this is like for everyone. Care. And I believe that, you know, I want all my favorite artworks to be there for everyone. So I
maybe
think
you need to free art that's like locked up in someone's storage or something. I guess you do that anyway in your job because you loan work. So actually you're already doing that. And our second question is, what is your favorite color? Which may seem simple, but actually some people have very deep answers.
Yeah, I mean, identity is shifty. As says Etel Adnan, identity is a choice. And so I think in a way that's always changing.
But I would today, say, what is it today?
But I would say it's very often red.
Is really? It?
Yeah, because I think it's, you know, it's again what Etel said, you know, when you have many colours in the painting, always red kind of has a very strong presence. Yeah,
but you've mentioned her a lot. She's had a big influence.
I know.
On
Russell
you,
and I both live with her work, and we're both massive fans of both Etel Adnan and Simone Fatel.
Yeah, we were at
and
MoMA
we just went
PS1.
To MoMA PS1 recently and saw some.
Yeah, I have to see her very regularly because it always gives me a lot of hope that we can change the world. It gives me a lot of positive energy, and I think her work does that.
Yes,
you know?
And her writing.
Her work and her writing gives us this positive energy. So you know.
She's not done a show here yet.
Yeah, she has. When there was a solo show about 4 years ago.
Was it? Oh, I didn't
see
it. I don't know. I saw that weirdly. I saw an amazing show by her in Beirut.
Yeah.
And it completely changed my life.
It was in the Zaha Hadid, in the building across the bridge.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Here we had a solo show of her with quite a lot of paintings,
great.
Drawings, Leporellos. And and she, Etel says red always wins.
Really?
Yeah, which I think is kind of interesting in relation to.
I thought you'd say green because of the park. I thought you were saying she needs to see trees every day.
No, I think green is definitely, you know, the color which is always with me. And I would also say that that the idea of looking at the tree, I really can't live without seeing a tree and very often, you know, when I'm in a hotel room and I don't see a tree, I really suffer. I think we need trees. And it's important also because the idea of gatherings under trees. I mean, when we did the pavilion with Francis Kéré, who works between Berlin and Burkina Faso, he was explaining to us that, you know, his childhood was always under a tree. All the gatherings happened under a tree, which is why he designed the pavilion for us here. That's, of course, very exciting that we could now, you know, more and more go into the younger generation of architects. The pavilion scheme has opened up and we do a research into emerging generation of architects. This year it's Ishigami, the year before was the youngest architect, Frida Escobedo, she is from Mexico.
Yes.
And the year before was Francis Kéré, who is from Burkina Faso and Berlin. And Kéré talked about this idea, he wanted the pavilion to be like a tree. We have gatherings under a tree. So yeah, so you're right. I love green too.
But red always wins.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking about red, though. It's the kind of, for me, red was always about like life force and blood and
energy. You
know, and energy.
And I think I love energy.
Yeah, but also the tree is too. So it kind of is a beautiful way
to
end the show.
I think we have to decide. We can say both green and red.
It's, exactly,
you know,
yeah.
It's both and instead of either or, instead of no. What's your favorite?
You need red for the energy of all the information inside your brain.
What's your favorite color?
Oh, God, turn the tables. Orange, blue. It changes. Orange and blue.
Orange and pink, but orange a lot in my life.
Yeah.
I love orange. I think it is really invigorating and kind of inspiring. And I like wearing the colour orange. If I wear orange, I feel like I'm...
Do you like orange juice?
I love orange juice. I had some this morning.
Did you? Oh, my God. You didn't actually because we gave it away.
But no, I got some later. After
so do you have in your podcast a unicorn, somebody you couldn't so far get?
Because
you
asked me before. We want David Hockney.
Yeah,
that's the dream.
I actually really want Etel Adnan. I haven't actually asked her yet, so it's not that we couldn't get her, but I haven't got around to doing that.
Can you?
Yeah, of course.
We love Etel so much. And Simone, I would love to introduce both of them.
She's not traveling that much these days. She goes to the countryside in summer to escape the heat from Paris, and then she's in Paris. So you'd have to go to Paris. But if you're fine to travel there, you just let me know.
And is Simone there as well?
Yeah,
I'd love to introduce both of them. They're both totally incredible.
She'll be back in September.
Thank you so much. It's been such a privilege to speak with you.
It's been amazing.
And you know, a lot of artists that have worked with you, when I meet them, they'll often say what a privilege it was to work with you. And we just saw Rose Wiley the other day, and she said what a joy it had been to to spend time with you, particularly when she did her show here.
We love Rose so much.
Oh, she's just the best. Yeah.
Quack Quack. Brilliant show.
Yeah, so great. Well, thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you very much.
And for everyone listening, you can see images of all the artworks we've spoken about in today's episode on our Instagram at Talk Art. And you can follow Hans Ulrich on Instagram as well. What's your at?
It's just my name, at Hans Ulrich Obrist.
At Hans Ulrich Obrist. And you can see all those incredible messages and handwriting, which we need to remember. Everyone, yes. keep writing on paper with pens.
And take a photo of it.
Take a photo of it. we'll be back very soon.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. Great to see you.
Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.